But that's not a matter of the light. It doesn't get hotter or cooler. And the hours of Sesshin roll by. The Tenzo remarked to me about how he came in to show a latecomer a place to sit this morning after furiously being at work preparing the breakfast, and stepped into the room and felt a wave of, well, he didn't say light, but a wave of like, whoa, this is someplace different than I just was. There's like a feeling of bright stillness, and the room kind of changes as we sit here. It's different than the busyness of the rest of the world. And sometimes the contrast, we don't notice when we're just sitting here, but sometimes the contrast is apparent stepping into it suddenly. This is a photograph of Shirto's stone. You can pass it around. In China, I didn't go there, but a friend went with Andy Ferguson to Shirto's temple, and as you heard, he's called on top of the rock or on top of the stone because he sat on the stone. So there's the stone that he supposedly sat on, and a statue of him sitting on top, and then his stupa where his relics are enshrined. How many years later? If that was around 800, not quite 800 or 1,000 years plus a couple hundred. But just like yesterday, when Shirto lived, things weren't that different. Sometimes I feel like, over 1,000 years ago, on the other side of the world, in a completely different culture, does this stuff really apply to us today? In Santa Cruz. But it seems like the issues they were dealing with were exactly the same ones. That's what's so surprising and yet unsurprising about human nature, and about how the Buddha Dharma is just so universally applicable. Now, we usually don't talk this kind of way these days, but maybe even in old China, most people didn't talk this way. I would be surprised if they did. But Zen people developed this whole kind of language, right? This whole way of speaking with each other to point towards the unpointable. So Keizan commenting on this story, continuing, through this story you must experience carefully the whole of understanding and true realization. See it minutely and reach it close up. When Shirto said, it's not only not existent at Cao Chi, but it doesn't exist in India either. Although he could demolish heaven and earth and expose the whole body standing alone, he still suffered the misfortune of recognizing a self. maybe seem strange, because to say, well, it doesn't exist here or there or anything, is that recognizing a self? But Keizan is implying that there's still something there, like one of those sicknesses of Yun Min. There's still some sense of himself. That's why he could speak so grandly. However, in the end, he realized that the whole thing was exposed when the whisk was raised. He knew it existed when he was struck. So, first seeing that nothing existed in any of these places, that was revealing a self, some kind of fixed self. And yet, when struck with the whisk, then he knew it exists, and he was freed. This dialectic between existence and non-existence is woven through so much of Buddha Dharma. So we have these terms, u, that means to be, in Japanese, u means exists or is. And that's the actual character that's being used. Does this exist or not? Is there this issue of whether it exists? U, and then we have mu. So they're often seen as a pair. Mu means doesn't exist, or not existing, or simply no. Like Zhao Zhou's mu. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Doesn't exist. Now these words are hard to translate the feeling of them exactly, but u and mu are often seen as a pair. And mu is the one that's all through the Heart Sutra. Mu eyes, mu ears, mu nose, mu tongue, mu body, mu mind. And u is the same u as in uji, which we translate as being time. We could translate as existent time. So we'll, in this class series this fall, this is part of the issue that might come up. It's in the very title, being time. So Keizan's here saying, when he was struck with the whisk, then he knew for the first time that it exists. It, ooh, it is. Praising him in this way. So again, a little clue that this is not just the mere negation of Prajnaparamita. Lately, Zen people get lost in sounds and sights and search in seeing and hearing. Even though they intone the Buddha's words, get mired in words on the road to liberation, and say that it does not exist either in Saochi or in India, they still do not understand. So he seems to be saying that it's very easy to say it's not in Saochi or India. It's easy to say that in words, which are like Buddha's words, but people become mired in words on the road to liberation, and saying such words of Buddha, they don't understand. And now Keizan, as he sometimes does, gets into his kind of admonishing mode. So this might sound strong, but see if you can hear his compassion behind it as he speaks to his students who he knows are very sincere about completely getting to the bottom of this great matter. So if they get mired in words like this, and this is how they are, then even though they shave their heads and wear the robes, thus resembling Buddhas, they cannot finally escape the bondage of imprisonment in the triple world, in the just every possible place they could be, and still stuck. You know about the triple world, the desire world that we live in virtually all the time, where there's things and we desire them, and then the form world and formless worlds that are only entered through deep letting go meditation. But still, these are the three worlds of samsara. There's still bondage even in the formless realms. How will they ever stop coming and going in the six realms? Alas, people like this vainly hang the patched robe on blocks of wood. The Buddha said, they are not children of Buddha. There's no name for them. They're no different from blocks of wood. This is what I mean. Vainly squandering the donations of the faithful for a whole lifetime, when they end up miserable from drinking molten pellets in hell, they will really have many regrets. Strong words. Please excuse Kazan. It's some fire and brimstone going on here. Molten pellets of hell, right? So he's speaking to monks who are receiving the donations of the faithful in order to practice the way. Of course, this is an issue when being supported by kind-hearted, generous people, as we all are in some sense. And the more we're supported like that, the more responsibility we must have for practicing. I think this is part of the setup of this, of monks being supported by donations of the faithful. I know at times when actually, you know, living on alms, and people who don't even know what Buddhism is, and offering something to the robe and bowl, the symbol. It's like an anonymous robe and bowl, and feeling the strong sense of like where this money goes is very very, or money or food or whatever is offered, it shouldn't be squandered, because it's offered out of faith to support practice, even if people don't know what practice is. And we could even say the same thing about donations to the Zen Center. The Buddha has this sutra called, in the early canon, called something like the Sutra on Purifying Alms Food. And so you think from the title it might be like you do some mantra for it, if it's like old food or something, and that kind of refreshes it and purifies it. But it's not like that at all. The method for purifying alms food is to practice and realize the way. At that point, the donors, I mean, this is, you could argue this is old Indian culture, but the merit and value of that gift is like comes to full fruition. It's kind of the responsibility of the recipient. Right. Yes.
I know this is off the main topic.
It is.
It's lovely. I mean, I think it's a great reminder, and it seems to me anything that comes to us in any way is exactly the same.
Innumerable labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us.
How anything comes to us. If we could imagine if we actually could consider it in this.
Yeah, exactly. I think that line and that contemplation are about gratitude, actually. They're about deep gratitude and however anything comes to us. And I think, really, it's not that different if we're, at least as a training, even if we're, you know, so-called doing some work for some income, I think it's really valuable to not see it that way. Like, I'm, you know, doing this and it's earning this, but actually I'm offering my life and it looks like work and maybe there's been a contract here and I have these job hours and so on and I get paid this much per hour. But actually, to see it as like, I'm just giving my life because I want to give to this company or whatever, and then this company's giving me support just because they want to give me support. I think this is a very different way than we usually think of the working world, but just it's not changing anything actually in what's happening, but just our perception of it makes everything into gift. We can see everything as mutual gift, which is a really beautiful world to live in, right, where everything is constantly being given to everything else. With that emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift. Thus, if you investigate fully and completely and reach that place Shruto reached in the beginning, where the whole body is exposed alone, you will understand that there is nothing at Sauchi or in India. Where can you come and go? In this realm of vision, you will not wear the patch robe pointlessly. So he's constantly shifting back and forth. Now there's like, even to realize this answer that was later criticized, right? It's not in Sauchi or India, but it's saying that that's not not so bad. It's just not the complete story, but if you can realize that ultimately nothing truly exists, that's, we could say, the purification of alms food, or you will not wear the patch robe pointlessly. Even more will you understand that it exists when struck by the whisk, like Shurto, and quickly forget the self and understand the, in parentheses, true self. So it's the same word there, though. Quickly forget the self and understand the self. So we have these different kinds of selves, and this is some of this shows up in the Genjo Koan. You will be alive in the midst of death, and in the dark your eyes will be bright. This is the intimate matter beneath the patch robe. As you maybe have heard, this story this is referring to, right? Which we won't get to this Sashin, but it's one of the later ancestors, the 42nd ancestor, Liang Shan, studied with Dung An and served him. Dung An asked, what's the business or the matter beneath the patch robe? The master had no answer. Dung An said, studying the Buddha way and still not reaching this realm is the most painful thing. Now you ask me. And Liang Shan asked, what is the business beneath the patch robe? Dung An said, intimacy. And Yangshan was awakened. Yes.
You just reread the part before, just before he said this is the intimate matter beneath the fat throat.
Even more. So first he says, if you fully, if you investigate fully and completely and reach this place, sure to reach in the beginning, where the whole body is exposed alone, you'll understand that there's nothing at Tsao Chi or in India. Right? That's at the beginning, that was his understanding. Well, then where can you come and go? In this realm of vision, you will not wear the patch robe pointlessly. In this vision of emptiness, you have, you know, fulfilled your responsibility for wearing the patch robe. Even more will you understand that it exists when struck by the whisk, and quickly forget the self and understand the self, here, capital S, self. You will be alive in the midst of death, and in the dark your eyes will be bright. So the light comes into play here when you realize it exists. This is the intimate matter beneath the patch robe. So this light that's woven through these stories of transmission of light is the matter of intimacy beneath the patch robe here. Since he had already seen it in this way, Sherto eagerly went to the South Monastery at Mount Hung in the early 740s. East of the monastery there was a stone terrace on which he built a hut. At that time he was called on top of the stone, Sherto. Here's a little part I thought about skipping. But I think last time we did this Denko A, it was a little skipping around. I think there must have been, because we made it through six ancestors in, I think it was 5 days or something. Maybe there wasn't, but I think there's some value in just hearing the entirety, right? For sake of completion. It's just not that interesting. It's a little like, it's not talking about the story anymore. Now we just have, we have other anecdotes about Sherto. And this one is like, well, I shouldn't say, you know, this might really work for you. I mean, it's definitely teachings going on. It's about a dream Sherto has. But when I first studied this, with my teacher, was like in a group where he would just read it himself. He would just read through the whole thing, and we just would stop and talk about it when anybody would like to stop and talk about it. And so my memory, I have this feeling, this kind of heart feeling about this text through the long, long time ago, through that my teacher's voice I hear through this, right? It was the query translation. But those times stand out because of just hearing these words. Once while Sherto was reading the treatise of Song Zhao, which was a pre-Zen treatise, but like Song Zhao was, without getting too divergent, he wasn't actually an interesting character, because it was around the time of Bodhidharma, and it was very Zen-like teaching, but not usually considered in relation to the Zen tradition. But playing with middle way kind of philosophy, but in a new and kind of poetic way, which is what Zen was doing, but maybe a little more philosophical than Zen. So he wrote this treatise. I think it's called I don't know if it's this one. It might be. I think his most well-known one is Nirvana Has No Name. So Shuto was reading that. It was written maybe not so long before his life. When he came to where it said, quote, "Is it only the wise person who understands the myriad things as himself?" Unquote. That line, like, hit him. Is it only the wise person who understands the myriad things as himself? He struck his desk and said, "For the sage, there is no self, and there's nothing that's not his self. The Dharma body is formless. Who can speak of self and other? The round mirror reflects clearly, and the wonderful forms of the myriad things appear in it spontaneously. Knowledge and its objects are not one or two. Who can say they come and go? How true these words of the treatise are." So, for the sage, there's no self, and there's nothing that's not his true self. This is a little third-turning flavor in there, right? It's not that for the sage there's no self, period. This issue of what is this true self? What is our actual being in the realm of ooh? Yes.
It is not in China and India. China and India is in it. I am. It is not in me, but I am it. And this says everything is in it. Therefore, everything is one, and that's intimacy.
Yeah, one. As opposed to none.
We're all in it.
Mm-hmm. It is the realm of oneness is kind of different than the realm of emptiness, right? They sound almost opposite, but not that different. It's just that one, there's nothing there, and one, everything is there, but it's one.
It seems to me, and maybe this is just a construction.
Well, it all is.
The only thing that does contain everything is the present moment.
We can call it that, but it's not limited to the present moment. Like a hammer striking emptiness before and after, its exquisite peal permeates everywhere. How could it be limited to this moment?
If this moment does not exclude the past or future.
Yeah. This all-inclusive time being. For the time being, raise a whisk and have a bath.
Even our notions of what is past or what is coming are constructed at this moment.
Yeah, anything we're experiencing is constructed. There's no escape. And yet, the light, it is said, is not constructed. And we are in it. All our constructions are held in the unconstructed light. So after he struck his desk and said, "What a great treatise." Then he rolled up the scroll and fell asleep. In a dream, he and the sixth ancestor were riding on a turtle, swimming around in a deep lake. When he awoke, he thought about the dream carefully He interpreted the marvelous turtle to be wisdom and the lake to be the ocean of nature. He and the ancestral teacher were riding on marvelous wisdom, swimming on the ocean of essential nature. That was his dream interpretation. Later, he wrote the Sandokai, the merging of difference and unity, which is well known all over the world. I thought, at that time it wasn't known all over the world, but now it actually is, right? Probably all over the world. This Soto Zen chant is chanted these days. It happened like this because his marvelous wisdom was equal to that of the sixth ancestor and no different from that of Qing Yuan. Not only that, but once he entered the hall and said, so now this is a kind of a little talk he gave later. He said, my teaching was received from the ancestors of the past to arrive at the knowledge and perception of a Buddha without recourse to meditation and effort. Or other translations say, the knowledge and perception of a Buddha doesn't depend on meditation and effort. The Buddha that we're speaking of is not a matter of meditation practice and great effort. Just that particular line gets quoted elsewhere too by Dogen. This line gets quoted elsewhere also, that this teaching of the Buddhas and ancestors, knowledge and wisdom of the Buddha in this tradition does not rely on meditation and effort. So why, you might ask, are we doing this sesshin? What else would we do? This body is Buddha. Mind, Buddha, beings, awakening, and afflictions. These words are different, but the substance is the same. Substance, essence, roughly we could say nature. This word substance appears a lot in Chinese Buddhism. Say something like nature. Their actual nature is the same. This body is Buddha. Mind, Buddha, sentient beings, awakening, klesha, defilements. The words are different, but the essence or the nature is the same. You must realize that the substance of your own mind is beyond annihilation and eternity, and its nature is beyond purity and impurity. So this is also, now we're talking about this light, the nature of our mind as radiance that's beyond annihilation and eternity. It's not nothing and it's not eternally something. It's not pure and it's not impure. Deep and complete, it is the same in sages and ordinary people. It responds freely and differs from mind, intellect, and consciousness. So, you might recall that in the Yogacara tradition, these are the sixth, seventh, and eighth consciousness are translated like this in Chinese. The just conceptual consciousness, what we could call the just mental consciousness that both conceives of things and is aware of things, but in a dualistic way. The seventh consciousness, sometimes translated as intellect, but it's the one that actually splits experience into a subject and object. And then citta, mind, as a synonym for alaya, the storehouse consciousness that contains the other two and the five sense consciousnesses. So these three appear a lot. They're just basically, you know, he's not getting into the delineating them all here, but he's saying this nature of mind that's the same in sages and ordinary people that responds freely, it differs from our regular consciousness. Here, this translation actually says it differs from ordinary mind in its various functions. But looking at the Chinese, it doesn't say ordinary mind. It says differs from mind, intellect, and consciousness, or this citta, manas, and manovijnana, which is also that line in the Fukan Zazengi, right? It's not a matter of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Or our translation says, I can't remember. Do you all know this part where, I think we'll chant it tomorrow morning. Stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views. Give up the operations of the conscious mind.
Seesaw
the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. So the conscious mind in there is the same three. Mind, think, intellect, and consciousness. Some other translations say it like that. So that's a Dogen Zazen instruction. Give up these operations of these, of all our just regular consciousness. That's a tall order. Oh, it doesn't mean stop them, because it can't be stopped. But to give them up, let go of all of these dualistic functions of mind, right in the midst of them, opening the hand of thought.
So, yeah, I was going to say that. So it means don't settle on them as definitive.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing going to be there.
Yeah.
Don't settle on them as definitive.
Mm-hmm. Which is very challenging in a moment-to-moment way in Zazen, as we can feel some of those thoughts get really, we start cranking down the vice grips around them, or you can feel it in the body sometimes too, right? It's like for example, why am I doing this? The afternoon's getting so hot, I could be at the beach. Crank it further. And wearing all these patch robes, layers and layers of them. But that's just the workings of mind, intellect, and consciousness. So it can be going on, but we can, I think, without having heard any of this, I think we just by sitting here over and over again in Sesshin, we just get familiar with our crazy mind, don't we? It's inevitable. We just see how crazy it is. And like, you can have one period where you're totally obsessed and you're ready to kill, and you can have the next period in just total ease and like, please don't ring the bell. So it's not dependent on the external situation, really, we come to see. Yes?
Is that not intimacy yet?
That being with what's happening,
yes.
Watching it?
Yes.
Yeah, that's intimacy. Mm-hmm. Everything's arising and ceasing. And sometimes when we talk about, you know, emptiness, it sounds so deep and complex. And in a way, we can say it is. And there's another way when we're really right there with what's happening. And not involved, right? Like as Ajo says, even if 84,000 jumbled thoughts arise and cease, if one doesn't get involved with them, thoroughly relinquishes them, they become the light.
And yet, I would say that even just, you know, even if you are involved, that's intimacy. Because you're really tasting your mind.
Yeah.
Tasting your actual mind, you know?
This is where it gets tricky, because in a way it's involvement without involvement.
What do you mean?
Well, how can we say, like, if we know that we're involved, I mean, the very thinking itself is involvement, right? So to say, like, here's a thought, but I'm not involved in it, in a way the thought itself is a kind of involvement. So this is where it gets tricky to talk about. Not adding anything extra to it, not grasping it, we could say, but in actual experience, it's not so, I think we can't delineate so clearly between the thought and the grasping of it. Actually, I mean, this is something we can work with in Zazen to see, but it's almost like the power of the thought itself is already, maybe not big time grasping, but it's, if it's a thinking about some external situation, even if it's like our own body, external to the mind that's thinking it, it's already, there's a, you know, technically, that's called a kind of a grasping.
Is gently touching the same as grasping?
Gently touching the experience?
Gently touching, just gently touching and not grasping, but there you are, there you are.
Yeah, this is the realm of...
Touching, you know, and I'm just sort of, I don't know, I'm just wondering.
What kind of touching?
Well, like when you were, you know, the confession, say. I mean, I think that's wholesome. You know, confessing, wow, my robe's really hot and I wish I was at the beach.
I actually didn't have that particular thought,
I mean,
but I might any moment.
Or you know,
I confess that it wasn't an accurate confession.
You wanted to skip the paragraph about.
Oh yes, or, yes, you know, yes, yes.
Now I know something about you.
Yeah.
Intimate, just intimate. Let's keep playing patty cake with it. And yet,
expression.
And yet, it's like no, it's not nothing. You know, you're going to be arising in a particular unique way. We all are.
Yeah.
And that's part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's always all these different perspectives we can speak from, too. Like the poles being, you know, the extreme kind of polarities being everything is it. And because actually everything is just illumination of this light, so there's that realm where we can't go wrong, everything is it. And then the other pole is like, no, none of this is it. We have to not even like see dualistically at all. That kind of very kind of strict, narrow, nothing is it. And so those are these poles that we find woven all through the teachings. We hear both as legitimate dharma, and then something in between those is our experience, usually. And so, how to find it? What's authentic, or what's grasping? Because we also have these teachings like in. Hung Jur's meditation instructions and the point of Zazen, right? It's like knowing without touching things. So what kind of knowing is this that doesn't touch at all, doesn't touch things, like there's no contact of the knower and things. So that sounds like even less than a light touch. Sometimes we hear things like that. So, yeah, how do we tell if we're on track? Like we have some basic criteria, it seems like, like how we're doing. You know, is this like, and it's not a matter of emotional doing, like happy, I don't think, but there's some sense when we feel like kind of stuck and constricted, and there may be a place where we're actually really sad or not so happy, but we actually feel like free and at ease in the midst of that. The light's penetrating freely, the breath is flowing freely. So that'd be one thing of like, well, yeah, there's stuff going on in the mind here, but there's not so much fixation going on. Maybe there's degrees of fixation too, but there's not much. And then other criteria are like our open, compassionate heart. It's like if we're feeling, you know, pretty free and at ease, but like want all these people to go away or something, or like we're not ready for meeting suffering beings, then that's probably some holding that would be good to work with. Devotion is another sign. It may be hard to say what devotion is, but like I think really similar to compassion, actually. We're just open to what's happening. We have formal forms and ceremonies to express devotion. It might not take that form, but it might take the form of, if we're in sesshin and those things are happening, we're just devoted to them because they're what's happening. So that was a little divergence into the mind of zazen. It's really hard to talk about, I think, in this issue. In a way, this is the realm that Qingyuan saying that must be, or Keizan saying, must be experienced by oneself. It's good, I think, to talk about it and turn the words out, because each time we have a conversation, it turns us a little bit more in one way or another. It eases us out of one view, maybe towards another one. But in the end, all these words are just pointers, right? The triple world and the six realms appear spontaneously as mind only. So this is in Sherto's Dharma talk. So literally he's saying chitta matra, mind only, which in, so you can see in early Zen here, it's even quoted quite directly that the three worlds appear spontaneously as mind only, which actually is a quote from the Avatamsaka Sutra also. How can the reflection of the moon in water or the shapes reflected in a mirror originate or cease to be? Classic images. So the moon of Buddha nature, we could say, our true light, is reflected in the water, and we see these reflections in the water, and likewise the mirror, the jewel mirror, mind, doesn't ever change, but the reflections are constantly coming and going on the mirror. By the way, these are, I think, really great images for when you're sitting zazen and you're kind of like getting bored and wondering what to do. Just the image of like mirror mind, almost like make your mind like a mirror, or if that sounds like doing too much, just open to how your mind is already like a mirror. That's what it's like. And so as all our experience is coming, maybe this goes back to Kathy's inquiry. If the mind's like a mirror, does it touch those images in it? there is stuff happening. There are images in this mirror. But does the mirror touch them, even lightly? It doesn't. It's not a dark mirror. It's clear, bright. It reflects all this garbage and joy that's reflected in it without changing. So I think it's a really great image. It's just a metaphorical image for the mind of Zazen. The mind all the time, like a mirror. Can we let our mind be in its mirror-like nature, just receiving every image that lands on it? And obviously a mirror doesn't like grasp the image and say, oh, make this one last a little longer. Or like, no, not this image. Move along, please. It's just like, however long you'd like to stay. I'm not controlling this at all. I'm just receiving. And the mirror itself is perfectly at ease. It has no discrimination amongst images, but it reflects images, right? It's not blank. It's not like nothing's happening. These kind of questions you shouldn't ask me so long into the talk. It's time to talk.
Well, it's shikantaza.
Mm-hmm.
It's so, if a sound comes, the sound goes.
Yeah.
Mostly it sounds.
Unless our eyes are open, and then it's images, and if there's food on our tongue, it might be taste. But the six senses, yeah, the six sensory experiences. But also, I mean, the mirror is just a metaphor, so it also would include like thoughts being reflected in this mind without discrimination. But where they come from, if there's no external world, this is the realm of this mind-only tradition that says all of that, those reflections are rising out of this storehouse consciousness. They're not external objects. So that's one of those radical things about this mind-only tradition. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's also, you know, my perception, so now, you know, I don't know really, how do you know if you're seeing in a clear mirror, or if you're in the carnival house and you're in the tall, skinny mirror and the short, fat mirror and the this and that mirror. Mm. You know, they're all mirrors. Mm. They're all reflecting. Mm. I like some of the reflections, but that's beside the point.
But the mirror, well, maybe that would be one thing, is the clear mirror doesn't prefer any reflections over any others, right? But you could say that
the mirror doesn't prefer. Yeah. But how?
But that's interesting image of a curved funhouse mirror, mm-hmm. because we might be reflecting something and feel like we're not holding the image, and yet we're distorting it somehow.
Well, I mean, as a conditioned being.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't I by nature a distorted mirror?
Mm.
And so perhaps I can have fleeting moments where I just, where the sound just arises and it's just sound and it seems pure, but even that is a defilement of it. So, I mean, that's a categorizing of it, pure or dust, sound. So, I mean, I have a sensing of sound.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just am never. So when I look at someone else as a mirror, because we're all looking in one another that way too, am I seeing myself reflected? Am I seeing the other person reflected? You know, I don't know. I'm never convinced that what I'm seeing is what's there. That I haven't chewed it up and spit it out in some way that isn't it.
The mirror metaphor, if we got more detailed about it, we could say, are we talking about the mirror of the sixth consciousness, which would be like hearing sounds, but we know, but there is a, like an external sound, but we're just receiving the image, but it still is distorting it. The sixth consciousness is distorted, even though it's what we use to meditate with, particularly for like a, you know, the calm abiding kind of meditation. You could say it's using the sixth consciousness. It's still a dualistic consciousness that's reflecting objects that seem to be external to itself. But that's when I say, like, in Zazen, to kind of make your mind like a mirror and imagine that it's not the whole story, but it's a great Zazen practice. Just receive these things. And we could do it in a way where they're less and less distorted. And I think that's distortion in this kind of metaphor means conceptualization. So there's just sound coming in and so on. And still, if from a strict perspective, that still is a distortion, because there's an, from a mind-only point of view particularly, there's still this external sound. There's still some sense that there's a car out there going by. Even if we're barely naming it a car. So then there's the mirror, there's the great perfect mirror wisdom. That's an, I would say actually it's a different metaphor. That's like a completely non-dual mirror mind, where actually there isn't even these external sensory objects anymore. So, and that one, it's not like we can do it in Zazen. I think, but because they're both like mirror mind, they're both related in a way, as a basic practice, we might still be distorting. But it's a place to start that's quite different than the usual mind that's not like a mirror, but more like Velcro or something. That's like everything that comes in is kind of like latching onto it, sticking to it. Yes.
The way I get at this is the nature of the mirror is it has no opinion. It manifests something that is reality to people or things that have opinions about it. So we could say that's a flattering mirror that makes me look skinny. I like that mirror. But for me to sit in Zazen and be mirror-like simply means to have things come and go, light, if you will, come and go without an opinion.
I think that's a good way to put it for this basic sixth consciousness mirror mind. It's like, yeah, no opinion. And again, we get into these issues of the great ways without difficult for those who hold no preferences. you know, what if what's being reflected is like an opinionated thought? It's like we're not having an opinion about that. And I think if we reflect it more and more clearly and we don't add to the opinionated thought, it ceases, because every thought is ceasing every moment if we're not like feeding it with more opinions. But the basic practice is equal reception of everything, which is the same as saying no particular opinion.
So I can have the opinion. But in Zazen, I don't have to have an opinion about the opinion. It's like, what do we have an opinion? I'm having an opinion.
Yeah, and if we really don't have an opinion about the opinion, it usually doesn't last that long.
No, it's just like...
It continues when we're kind of feeding it, or like reifying the opinion,
right. So
justifying the opinion.
Just go,
mm-hmm.
You know, like a cloud on the sky.
Mm-hmm. Koji.
When I'm trying to, you know, have this... Vajrapani, I asked them, how do they define mind? And they said, that which is clear and knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of like the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so when I'm trying to find mind, I think of like that which is clear and knowing. And like nothing but that, you know, clear, and that leaves it
mm-hmm.
an open field.
Yeah, that can include a lot, yeah.
And when I try to put effort forth seeing that the mind as the blank screen or as itself, I can't. It feels like trying to play two parts on a piano with like one hand. It's like I can't see my own thoughts. Like and like this thing about seeing the thoughts come and like not and not like I don't ever. By the time I notice a thought, I've already. In order, I don't know. Like I can't do both of them at the same time or something.
Yeah, to say like to use thought as a meditation object, for example.
Yeah.
In reality, you might be like, well, you could use anything, but actually. Yeah, I think that's very true. In reality, it's too complicated. It does gets into that split thing that you're talking about. So that's why we say just more like let go of the thought. And then, so sometimes we might talk about that in a way that sounds something like we're being aware of the thought. In fact, in the earliest version of the Fukanza Zengi that Dogen wrote, and he was quoting an earlier meditation manual, but the part that now says, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. That's the essential art of Zazen. Interestingly, in the earlier version that Dogen himself first wrote, that essential art of Zazen was different. And it said something like, this, which is not original to Dogen, but he said, as soon as a thought arises, become aware of it. When you're aware of it, it will cease. This is the essential art of Zazen.
So we could paint this picture where it's like, so like this is my thought, this is like, and I'm here sitting, and these thoughts are coming, and I'm like okay the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be, that might be less, because that's not my experience, and that's what I always thought was being, that's what I always thought the request was, rather than like, here I am, and then I catch myself.
To try to, like, catch the one who's watching the thought?
Yeah, like, whenever I notice a thought, it's I notice that I'm already thinking, not like I'm sitting here and there's these thoughts breezing through my head, you know, that I'm watching.
It also reminds me of, I remember we did this whole practice period on Tassajara about this, you know, this thing about turning the light around and like, trying to actually get really, really concentrated and pay closer and closer attention to look into the source of the thought, which is a little bit like that. It sounds like you're kind of like looking at the thought, like, okay, where's the thought coming from? And people are getting really frustrated and like, how can I, I can't do it. And I'm trying so hard. And kind of like at the end of 3 months, this is his attention, Roshi, and I said, wait a second. Is what you're talking about here, this kind of like, you know, tracing back to the origin of the thought, is that the same thing as just like letting go of thought? And he said, yeah. I was like, what? Why didn't you tell us this? But sometimes he would do things like that just to see. Like, to me, that seems so much simpler. And like, you're not, it's not this complex kind of thing that you're just trying to like work out this, like, who's doing what here? And it's kind of all split. But it's often talked about that way, that if you do that in a way that's not trying to like figure it out or something, but just gently, with a gentle touch, something like that, you know, look back, look inward, back at the source, the backward step, that's the actual function of that happening. Often seem to be something like just letting go of thought. Like if you were to do that exercise and then stop and now say, now you're going to do the exercise of just when thoughts arise, just don't hold on to them, just let go. And then compare those two. They're like the same. Even though you could like approach them from these different instructions. That's something you can play with, this machine, if you want to try and see if they're the same for you.
Why would Dogen change it to something more perplexing?
Because that's what he was into. Yeah, there's a whole, like, Carl Bielefeld's book, Dogen's Manuals of Zen Meditation, has like many, many, many pages, maybe even chapters, on that very question. Because he examines the evolution of the Fukanza Zengi, and why did he change it to, basically, he changed it to a Zen koan from a kind of a straightforward meditation instruction, and it seems like it was something about that's the style of Zen, right? Is these wacky stories and not so straightforward instructions, right? Like the person the other night who came and says, "I've been practicing Vipassana for a long time, but I'm interested in exploring what Zen is about and how that's different." And in some ways, we could say, if we're explaining it theoretically, maybe not that different at all, but then the style is so different. So, you know, cast body and mind into the great treasury of light and don't look back. That's like Zazen instructions you don't hear in Vipassana world. I don't know if you like that or not.
Could you just say the alternate one again? Not the one that the non-thinking...
So the original version of the essential art of Zazen, I think, is something like, as soon as a thought arises, be aware of it. And at the moment of being aware of it, it will cease. And I think he says, if you remain like this, forgetful of objects, I think he adds that into, then forgetful of objects, meaning letting go of objects, you will naturally become unified, or something like that. So also it was said, I think another reason why it might have changed is, originally it was just about, this is just a meditation technique, but Zen includes much more than just like particular meditation techniques. But that manual is just about this technique, and then Dogen's going to say, well, Zen isn't limited to some like particular technique, it's like all inclusive of everything. It's, you know, right after he says non-thinking, this is the essential art of Zazen, he says, you know, like, this is the practice and a realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It's complete Buddhahood itself. So if we can't just say, just be aware of your thoughts and they'll cease. He maybe felt like we can't, that's too simple and coarse to call the perfection of Buddha's enlightenment. But to use this strange story of how do you think of what doesn't think? It's beyond thinking. Then we can say beyond thinking is the same as the light of all Buddhas, the treasury of light. And Buddha itself. So time is getting late, but this story is almost finished here. If Shuto had not demolished heaven and earth and seen himself as independent, this talk would never have occurred. As a result of attaining realization when he was struck and experiencing clearly original mind, he became the 35th ancestor. How can your own marvelous nature be distinct from his? How can the mind ground not be common to all? It's only due to arousing determination or not arousing it, meeting an awakened teacher or not meeting one, that one rises or sinks, and not all are miserable or happy alike. In other words, there are these conditions about arousing, determination, aspiration, bodhicitta, and meeting awakened beings. How can I examine this story? Would you like to hear? With one raising of infinity, here it says, with one raising of the whisk, he held up the totality of the way, but really it's more just like, with one raising of the totality of the way, never by so much as a hair did Shuto ever deviate from it. Tomorrow we can look at the next ancestor, Yaoshan. Thank you for your patience and diligent effort sitting here so long and listening to all this babble for hours and hours. It's a very beautiful thing to sit together like this, I feel. May our intention equally extend to every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.